This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Thanks for joining us. Before we get started, please make sure that you're leaving us those five-star ratings. Please make sure you have subscribed to the various publications that are out there, either here at podcast, on the YouTube channel, on Substack, or following us on Threads or on Instagram. The discussion here is going to take us down the dairy aisle. We're going to look at some of the nutritional aspects of the various types of products we might find on the dairy aisle and discuss some of the myths and misconceptions out there as to the various healthiness of things like milk or the plant milks that we might purchase, the nutritional aspects of butter versus margarine as relates to some of the health factors that we might see, relates to all of the concepts that we've covered previously in regards to things that might be necessary for nutrition, nutrients that might act as metabolic disruptors, nutrients that might act as endocrine disruptors, and whether or not a lot of the advertisements that we might see portraying the benefits of various dairy products hold true. And so with that, let's go ahead and let's talk about dairy products, myths and misconceptions, or as one of the students who are going to be joining me today, like to talk about it as the milk misnomers.
Warning. The following presentation contains information that might contradict what you have previously heard or believed to be true about how the human body works, and contains material that is not suitable for closed-minded individuals. Enjoy.
So a lot of the myths and misconceptions out there as it relates to like the dairy products stem from the fat leads to heart disease hypothesis. And we've had multiple hypotheses as it relates to cardiovascular disease and nutrition. And there was one that was, oh, it's the cholesterol in food. And research has shown that that's not accurate. There's been a lot of saturated fat leads to cardiovascular disease. And once again, yes, but no, because it depends upon what type of saturated fat we're talking about and where the origins of that saturated fat happens to be. And so we have multiple hypotheses coming into play as relates to one of the big principles in terms of the myths and misconceptions out there as relates to a lot of the dairy stuff. One of the things that's come out recently is they've changed kind of the terminology as relates to the plant-based milks. They've changed it to non-dairy.
Yes.
As opposed to plant milk, because a lot of people have kind of gotten up in arms about, well, if it's milk, it has to come from a mammal.
Yeah. And
that was one of the big talking points that kind of drove the purpose for why we're having this kind of Q&A discussion.
Right.
From the person from the Congress
people from, I think the big person was from North Carolina, talking about getting whole milk back into school lunches. And one of the other people that got up and started talking was the fact that, well, milk has to come from mammals. And it's one of the few times that, once again, I don't like doing the political stuff here, but it's one of the few times where conservatives actually cited science correctly. And so milk is something that comes from mammary glands and is a hallmark trait of being a mammal. And right. So that's one of the keys there. Now, in terms of just a couple of stats to throw out there before we start getting into some questions and answers discussion-wise here. One of the things we have to look at when we start looking at, okay, the myths and misconceptions out there about dairy products, whether it's milk, butter, margarine, eggs, whatever, because all those kind of fit into the category in terms of the grocery store of dairy. Somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2 to 3.5% of the population have an allergy to cow's milk. And so there is about 2 to 3.5% of the population that will have allergic reactions to milk that we have to take into account when we start talking about, okay, all of the health benefits and health issues that can come about from consuming different types of milk. So that there's that one kind of stat caveat. The other stat caveat is somewhere between 15 and 75% of the entire population of the world, depending upon what subpopulation you're looking at, are lactose intolerant, which means that they cannot digest lactose. And they cannot digest lactose after the age of 5.
Oh.
And that's because up until the age of 5, we have the enzyme capability of digesting lactose because lactose is found in human milk.
Right.
It's found in human milk. Actually, it's found in human milk at a slightly higher concentration than what we see in cow's milk.
Oh.
And in goat milk.
Hmm.
And so it's not that big of a difference, but it's a big enough difference to say, oh, there's more lactose in human milk than there is in all the other milks that we would consume that come from a mammal.
That's weird.
Mm-hmm. But so in order to be able to digest that, we have to have the enzymes to break it down, physiology.
Right. Yeah, and, exactly.
Yep. And so everybody's able to do that through during the suckling period.
Yep.
When infants are breastfeeding, and that enzyme stays active up until about the age of about 4 or 5, which is usually when we have completely weaned away from consuming milk. Now, within subpopulations of humans, during the agricultural revolution of historic periods, we're talking about like prehistory. Mm-hmm. Everybody talks about like the caveman time frame. So 20 to 30,000 plus years ago, subpopulations within the human population had small mutations where they continued to produce the lactase, the enzyme.
Mm.
And that corresponded with cultivation of cows, cultivation of goats for food purposes, not to eat as meat, but to use for other food purposes, whether it's for plowing fields or for, in the case of what we're talking about today, collecting of milk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because milk provides a huge nutritional benefit. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about some of the nutrients that we see in terms of the macromolecules and micro and trace elements that we need in terms of our diet. But that didn't happen ubiquitously across all of human population. So we didn't see it with everybody. We only saw it with subpopulations. And now that subpopulation, because of all of the other things that took place in human history, has spread across the globe. But that didn't happen everywhere. And so within indigenous populations within the Americas, within indigenous populations of Australia, within Asians, particular, what we would think about in terms of East Asian populations, because they did not cultivate animals for collecting of milk, they did not need that mutation to continue to be able to digest dairy products, continue to digest lactose. And so those populations become lactose intolerant. And so when we start looking, okay, what are the myths and misconceptions out there as it relates to milk and milk products? What we have to remember is, okay, some of the populations out there have an inability to digest down.
Mm-hmm.
And so should they be consuming butter? Should they be consuming cheese? Should they be consuming cow milk or goat milk?
Right.
Or any of the other types of milks that are out there? And they can consume it, but they're going to have the repercussions of that, right, in terms of all of the gastrointestinal distress that comes about from consuming the milk products if they cannot digest,
right,
the milk. And so those are the couple of caveats that we need to start with in terms of the discussion we're having here as relates, mm-hmm, to the myths and misconceptions out there, or as the title got passed around, milk misnomers.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we get started here, so we're just simply going to be doing Q&A here. So feel free to chime in. Feel free to direct the conversation where we need to direct the conversation, because it's one of the important things that's out there is the fact that we have very poor nutritional literacy.
Yeah.
That goes along with some very poor science literacy, which is why this last week I put into the Substack a little passage on needing to be aware of scientific literacy and being more astute in how we go about addressing the information that we're going to address.
Right.
But with all of that kind of as background, let's go ahead and let's get your questions, your comments.
So I do have a question, and this is about the person who actually is pushing for this whole milk thing in the first place. Do you know what the context is? Like, why did she think that whole milk is such a superfood, which superfoods aren't real, but why does she think that whole milk is so godly that it needs to be pushed in this regimen for the schools? Why?
Political.
Okay.
It's purely political. And I see Dalton smirk on the Zoom.
Yep.
Yeah. Lo and behold, it comes down to political. It comes down to political, based off of 2011. I can't remember the exact date, but, the former first lady, Michelle Obama, had a big, huge push for healthy schools.
Right.
As you've heard on some of my soapboxing in the classrooms, some of the stuff I agreed with, some of the stuff I disagreed with.
Right.
One of the things that they did, and it kind of goes into this poor nutrition literacy, is they got rid of whole milk in the guise of, okay, we're going to do 1%, 2% skim.
Yes.
And some of the research that came out, and there's a table in the scroll and the other part of the YouTube video that comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And it basically looks at, okay, what are the nutrient differences between skim milk, 1% milk, 2% milk, whole milk?
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually look at it in terms of the nutrients, the nutritional breakdown, there's very little difference in between whole milk, 2% milk, 1% milk, or skim milk. Most of it goes into the not understanding what those percentages mean.
Yeah.
And so when we're looking at, okay, what's 1%, 2% whole milk, what we're talking about is we're talking about milk fat. We're not talking about fat content, because the difference between them is minuscule in terms of the actual grammage of fat. But the labeling becomes, oh, fat is bad is the was kind of the push.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
That came out from the low-fat diet trend.
Yeah.
The low-fat bad diet.
Right.
That stemmed from some, it was a good research if you're looking at highly active people. It was bad research if you're looking at everybody else.
Oh, okay.
That basically looked at, okay, what nutrients do you need in high percentages versus what nutrients do you need in low percentages? And when you're very highly active, you need to have large amounts of carbohydrates. You need to have large amounts of protein. You don't need as much fat. In terms of your macronutrient breakdown.
Right.
And then from that, a lot of meals ready to eat style meals got developed.
Mm-hmm.
And the head researcher out of the University of Minnesota, I believe it was at the University of Minnesota, or he was at the Mayo Clinic, I can't remember which institute he was at, kept researching it. And he basically got on a kind of pigeonholed himself or railroaded himself into one avenue of research that looked at fat intake, in particular saturated fat intake, and heart disease. And okay. this is Ansel Keys is the researcher, if you want to look up his work. And that led to this position that dietary fat is bad. Now, dietary fat by itself is not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to be careful about sources of dietary fat? Yes. Do we need to be careful about the consumption of trans fats within the dietary fat? Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
But fat by itself, whether it's monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, or saturated fat,
mm-hmm.
has metabolic benefits to us.
Right.
Most of the heart disease issues that get associated with fat diet, particularly animal fat diet, which is where one of the avenues came in with the former positions that were taken by the White House in the from basically the Obama administration, looking at, okay, let's reduce animal proteins, and let's reduce animal fats, and let's increase roots and vegetables, which is good, which is a good position. But it misses the point in terms of, okay, what is actually nutritionally valid and what's nutritionally not valid? And so I know I'm kind of going a long way around to answer the question here, but the principal rationale that was given is that if we can get rid of whole milk from the schools, we can reduce some of the fat intake in the children. But at the same time, within the lower fat milks, there appears to be higher concentrations of several types of vitamins that can have benefit. The vitamin Bs.
Yeah.
There's slightly higher concentration of vitamin D in the lower fat milk than there is in the whole milk. Part of that has to do with the processing that takes place.
Right.
The chemical reactions that occur, but it's a concentration issue.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it might be due to fortification that takes place in the milk processing,
right?
That goes about, which leads into a whole other issue in terms of the non-pasteurized, quote unquote, raw issue. But the principal reason for the debate that was taking place at that point in time was to counterbalance the move that they saw as being political. And it wasn't political. There was very little politicalization in that move. It was a movement done under the guise that were trying to benefit the children, but once again, the principle that they were working on was good. Mm-hmm. We need to have schools that are pro-health in their orientation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, children who are in TK, transition kindergarten, children that are in kindergarten, children in first and second grade, mm-hmm. should still be consuming higher fat milk than children in fourth, fifth grade and beyond. Simply because of what is nutritionally necessary for them during growth times.
Right.
And that's because one of the things that we see in terms of growth adaptations is that dairy products that come from higher fat content dairy products mm-hmm. tend to provide greater growth stimulant than dairy products that come from lower fat content.
Oh, interesting.
There's no real hypothesis to explain why outside of possible stimulation on growth factors due to secondary signaling that takes place from metabolite availability.
Okay. Hmm.
But yeah, that's the whole reason for that kind of, I guess you can call it debate that was taking place in the U.S. House of Representatives in December. Was all about trying to make a political statement.
Oh, so basically what you're saying is they're just trying to make the previous health movement that wasn't political because it's an opposition tactic. So it's just basically saying we are us, they are them, let's go for whole milk.
Basically, yes.
Okay, so there's no deeper meaning to it. It's not like a study came out or something like that.
No, the most recent studies that have come out related to milk and dairy products is, I think the most recent one that I've seen is 2022.
Okay.
And basically that was looking at the nutritional differences between the plant-based drinks mm-hmm. and the different types of milk products.
Right.
And once again, those of you that have the YouTube video that will be accompanying this, I have the slides that we'll show at this point in time here that basically break down, okay, what is the energy density that we see? Mm-hmm. What is the carbohydrate differences? And the carbohydrate differences, the plant-based drinks have a very high carbohydrate.
Yes.
Relative to the animal, in the case of the study, looking at cow's milk as the principal.
Right.
In terms of what we look at in terms of sugar concentration, carbohydrate concentration per serving, which is usually referenced at about 100 grams of product. So there tends to be greater amounts of carbohydrate in the plants. There tends to be slightly higher amounts of essential amino acids, mm-hmm. slightly higher amounts of essential fatty acids in the animal milk relative to the plant-based drinks.
Right.
There is greater saturated fat. Once again, it goes back into this. We'll talk as we go through this. We'll talk about some of the nutritional literacy issues here. There's greater amounts of saturated fat in the animal milk than the plant-based milk. Mm-hmm. But there's greater amounts of long-chain fatty acids in the plant milk than there is in the animal milk.
Okay.
And the long-chain fatty acids can become problematic because long-chain fatty acids mm-hmm. tend to get stored at higher percentages than the short chain fatty acids.
Okay.
And short chain fatty acids tend to get metabolized into other fatty acids within the body more than the long chain fatty acids. And so we start looking at the differences between the different types of fats. Is once again, we got to kind of go back and remember some of the chemistry stuff.
Right.
And so when we look at fats, we talk about in terms of being short chain.
Yes.
Medium chain, long chain, mm-hmm. or extra long chain.
Oh.
And so most of the fats that we want to metabolize in terms of utilizing for like energetic purposes for making ATP mm-hmm. through beta oxidation processes are going to be those moderate to long chain fatty acids. But the plants tend to have the plant-based drinks tend to have longer long chain fatty acids than the animal-based milks.
Okay.
The animal-based milks tend to have a lot of short-chain fatty acids, a lot of essential fatty acids. Some of the plant-based drinks will have the essential fatty acids. When we talk about fat, when we talk about essential fatty acids, we're talking about like things like ELA, ALA, the omega-3s, the omega-6s.
Right.
EHA and ALA. Mm-hmm. In terms of the fatty acids that are there. And so when we start looking, okay, where are we getting the nutrients from? When we start looking at, okay, what is the nutrients coming in from the plant-based drink versus from the animal-based milk, we get better nutrient value from the animal-based milk than we do from the plant-based milk.
Oh.
Because once again, it's not about fat. It's not about carbohydrates. It's not about proteins by itself. It's about all the other things that are there. What type of amino acids are in the proteins?
Mm-hmm.
What type of fats are in the lipids? And mm-hmm. so when all we do is simply look at, okay, how many grams of fat do I have? How many grams of protein do I have? How many grams of carbohydrate do I have? We also have to look at, okay, what are the various qualities of those things?
Okay. All right.
And so when we break it down into this, oh, I'm going to oversimplify this and make whole milk some superfood.
Yes.
Because it says whole, and that means that nothing's been extracted from it. So since nothing's been extracted from it, and milk is this wonderful nutritious beverage.
Yeah.
It must be better than the ones that have had stuff removed from it. When the only thing that's actually been removed in, we start looking, okay, what's being removed in the 2% versus the 1% versus the skin versus the whole is simply the dairy fat.
Right. It's all about fat.
It's all about fat. That's the only difference between them.
Right.
And if you go to other parts of the world, you don't see these designations. Milk is milk.
No, yeah. You drink it or you don't.
And so, like I said, long answer to that question.
Yeah.
But
it's all political. Question. Yeah. Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Cause I was like, why, what inspired this person to make this statement and specifically push for whole milk? I had no idea, because you could push for so many other things. You could push for like vegetarian options, vegan options. You know, there's all kinds of diets now, paleo, pescatarian, whatever. I don't think kids are doing paleo and pescatarian diets. I mean, I knew people in my high school who did, but for like small children, I could see like vegetarian, vegan, but I don't know. I just had no clue why it was all about whole milk. That was very weird to me. I thought there was some weird underlying reason as to why she wanted to talk about that. I had no context. I just heard the clip and I was like, what is this?
Nope. That's really the only reason for it.
Just political. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good to know.
Yeah.
And that always means it's coming from a genuine place.
Yeah. And it was one that actually started multiple discussions across professional discussion boards and professional listservs that I get involved with.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I pointed out the fact that within the listserv conversation that the only reason why that point was being made was about poor nutritional literacy as relates to fat, because that's the only reason why they're making the comments. The only reason why it got cut in the first place, and the only reason why they are raising it now.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't even understand, because like you said, I've heard that fat is one of the worst things you could consume, just like sugar. Sugar has that connotation to it as well. But I don't understand, though. We hate fat. We've taken fat out of a lot of things at the schools, but whole milk. So there's obviously a very big disconnect there. Yeah, I don't even know. I'm not even sure. I guess the angle they are taking is just trying to be oppositional. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and the whole take fat out of the foods is based off of the faulty hypothesis that fat in the diet leads to health issues. It's very similar to the faulty hypothesis that sugar leads to diabetes.
Yes, which I hear very, very often. I hear that high sugar intake is the reason for specifically type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. Never type 1, because type 1 is obviously, that's something that you like usually recognize in kids. That's something people develop and it's not their fault. But like type 2 diabetes is typically associated with, in my experience, people who are overweight, people who overconsume sugar, high carbs, that type of thing. So I don't really know much about type 2 versus type 1, other than one is usually looked at as an autoimmune disease and the other you typically blame the person or shame the person for developing it, mm-hmm. which I don't think you should do that, but people typically take that.
They do. And once again, it goes back into poor understanding of what's going on and the fact that, oh, I saw this documentary, or oh, I read this book, or I read this newspaper article. That in what we tend to do a lot of in those avenues of publication is that we oversimplify, and when we oversimplify, we end up missing the point because we ignore the complexity of the issue.
Yes.
And we ignore the complexity of the issue because we don't think that people are wise enough to be able to grasp stuff the way in a way that can be explained with the complexity that's there.
Yes.
And so when we start looking at like with the topic that we're discussing here in terms of like the milk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of push on don't consume plant-based beverages.
Yes.
Because of the amount of sugar that's in the plant-based beverage.
Right.
And so once again, it goes to following a faulty hypothesis that increased sugar consumption automatically leads to
diabetes. And other things that people say.
Now there is a correlation there.
Yes.
But correlation is not the same as causation.
Right.
And type 2 diabetes is a symptom of chronic inflammatory responses.
Okay.
More than it is an overconsumption of
sugar. Okay.
Now, if I reduce my sugar intake once I've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, I can offset some of the symptoms of type 2 diabetes because I'm changing my metabolism. But the problem is that we're using the treatment option the lifestyle treatment option as an indication for what the causal issue for the disease happens to be.
Right.
So we're conflating the treatment for what is the root cause for the disease.
Yeah, not too helpful.
And the problem is that one of the problems with that is that we make this, okay, it's all about sugar in the diet.
Yeah.
But then when we start treating somebody who has type 2 diabetes,
Yes.
We don't just say, okay, just go full keto and don't do anything else. It's okay. Okay. You're going to reduce sugar intake and you're going to increase your amount of endurance exercise and you're going to increase the amount of resistance training and you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And you're going to do stress management. You're going to do, and so we have all these other things. And so we can't say it's one thing that's causing all of the problems and then have a multiple step lifestyle intervention as treatment. And then say, oh, it's just that one thing.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't make sense. No, it doesn't make sense. And so it's very similar to some of the why do we want to cut animal fat intake?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that gets associated with high amounts of animal fat intake is atherosclerosis.
Oh.
But here's the thing. It's not because of the animal fat.
Okay.
Atherosclerosis is an immune response. It's a clotting that takes place.
Oh.
And so this is where once again we are when we start looking at like atherosclerosis, and it's one of the reasons why we had the fault hypothesis of fat leads to heart disease.
Yes.
When I consume animal product, one of the things that I'm consuming with the animal product are antigen markers on the cells.
Oh. Yeah.
And they're non-self antigens and they're non-class antigens.
Right.
And so the pork antigen and the chicken antigen and the beef antigens that are there, they're going to trigger an immune response to that antigen marker. And when it happens, that antigen marker gets kind of trapped within the silent micron, the VLDL that gets packaged with all of the fat and everything else that gets packaged on the absorption side of the digestion and the transportation. What's happening is that when those VLDLs are circulating around in the bloodstream, they're going to scrape across the epithelial cells within the blood vessels.
Okay.
The cells on that line the vessel.
Yeah.
They're going to scrape across and they're going to cause little micro abrasions. Very similar to Velcro. So every time you open and close Velcro, you get little kind of snags.
Yeah.
Same thing happens with these VLDLs and these LDLs. And what happens is that as they scrape across, they leave little parts of what was on the VLDL and on the LDL attached to the membrane of those cells in the blood vessels.
Okay.
And because it's not self, that damage is going to, the damage itself is going to trigger an inflammatory response because damage triggers inflammation.
Yes.
But because the inflammation is linked with a non-self antigen, we get both a platelet response because it's in the blood vessels, but we also get an immune cell response.
Right.
And those two things together cause a scar to develop. And it's that scar that causes the atherosclerosis. And so when we start saying, oh, it's because of the fat, it's not because of the fat. It's because of all the other things that are associated with that food material that got digested, absorbed, and packaged together in the transportation round that led to the issue. And so once again, we start looking, okay, we're going to oversimplify this.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to say, okay, consuming high fat dairy products, full fat milk, full fat ice cream, full fat gelato, full fat cheese.
Yes.
All those things are health-wise bad for you because of high fat leads to heart disease is missing the connection point of, okay, what is actually causing the people that have a high animal protein diet to have a higher likelihood, a higher relative risk for developing cardiovascular disease relative to the population that doesn't eat as much.
Mm-hmm.
But even that doesn't hold true across all populations.
Huh.
And so we don't see the same relative risk for atherosclerosis in other populations outside of what we think about as Western populations. And even then, it's not in all Western populations.
Right.
And so we'll when we look at like West, quote unquote, Western diets, it's not ubiquitous. It's not the same diet everywhere.
No.
So everybody talks about like Western diet. Well, the Mediterranean diet is a Western diet and actually has higher fat content. It's a higher fat diet than what we usually label as being a bad Western diet.
Right.
Hmm. The diet issue and the high fat issue. Because if you look at a lot of the comments about milk and about dairy products, it's basically two things. It's how much fat is there or how much cholesterol is there.
Exactly.
And so those are the two things that almost are constantly being brought up in terms of don't drink milk, drink soy milk or drink oat milk. Don't eat eggs because of all the cholesterol that's there, even though we've known for almost 22 years now that dietary cholesterol does not impact circulating levels of cholesterol.
Oh, man.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
Well, it's also looking, okay, what do we mean by cholesterol? And so when we're talking about dietary cholesterol, talking about the actual cholesterol molecule.
Right.
Okay.
We're talking about circulating levels of cholesterol, we're talking about lipoproteins.
Mm-hmm.
LDL, HDL, VLDL.
Right.
Now there are cholesterol molecules stuck into those bigger molecules, but they're two separate things.
Oh, okay.
Most of the circulating levels of cholesterol we have in our body is coming from our body. It's not coming from the cholesterol that we consume.
Oh, that's weird to think about.
And so yeah, and so like a lot of the diets that get the fad diets that get brought up as, oh, this is much, much better for you than the Western diet. And whenever you hear Western diet.
Yeah, I always ask what diet? Which one? McDonald's every day? That's not realistic. I mean, I'm sure there's someone out there doing that. I'm not doing that. I live in the West.
Just cost effective.
It is. It's well, it's funny that you say that because it's actually more cost effective to eat poor quality food than to eat higher quality food. So like we talk about like food deserts, and we'll get back to the milk stuff here in a second.
Yeah, food deserts.
So we talk about food deserts, and what food deserts really are addressing are the majority of areas that you can get food, fast food, quick markets, the 7-Eleven, Circle K, AMPM gas station, or the bodega stores, or is it the supermarket with the fruits and vegetables?
Right.
And so if you're living in a food desert, you simply have higher amounts of the quote unquote fast food options than you have of the supermarket options.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start pricing out stuff for people who are living on very tight budgets, it's actually more cost efficient to eat the fast food stuff than it is to go to the store and buy all the things that we talk about as being more nutritious.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that the fast food stuff is any less healthy than the stuff you purchase at the store. Because it falls back onto what are the macronutrients? What are the micronutrients? What materials am I consuming? Am I consuming things that are metabolic disruptors? Am I consuming things that are endocrine disruptors?
Right.
And so we start looking at, ignoring Western diet versus Mediterranean diet versus this diet versus that diet versus a lot of the stuff that we see in the plant-based stuff gets processed and actually forms into metabolic disruptors and endocrine disruptors. There are plant hormones. There are plant hormones that are estrogen-like substances. They're chemicals that look like estrogen.
Is that where all this hysteria around impossible meat is coming from? Because I have heard this a lot about the estrogen-like quality of impossible meats, particularly Burger King.
That is part of it, and that's for a whole other talk.
Oh man,
I'm already mapped for.
That's a teaser. Rabbit hole. Okay.
Teaser. That's a story for another day.
Okay. All right.
As most students have learned when we're going to talk about something later, that's kind of the catchphrase that I throw out there. It's a story for another day. It's coming. Okay. It's already been addressed a little bit in terms of the endocrine disruptor discussion, and I'll kind of rejigger that for an update. But within plants, there's these substances known as phytosterols.
Okay. Now,
there are some phytosterols that are of benefit, but there are also phytosterols that are endocrine disruptors.
Okay.
Which is where that whole impossible burger issue comes into play in terms of, is it healthy or is it not healthy? So we have that issue when we start looking at some of the plant-based stuff. But the other thing that comes into play in terms of particularly the use of plant oils, because that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about the dairy stuff, because we're using plant oils.
Mm-hmm.
The plant oils get transformed in order to form the products that we're going to have in dairy.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that transformation leads to what's referred to as industrialized trans fats.
Oh.
Industrialized trans fat is the big new term for the partially hydrogenated oils.
Yes. The seed oils.
Yes.
From what I've heard them be referred to as.
Yes. And so when we talk about like seed oils, mm-hmm. and the use of oils to turn into solid fats, in order to do that, we have to take a molecule and we have to change the chemical nature of the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And in changing the chemical nature of the molecule, we take it and we transform it. And that transformation leads to what's referred to as a trans fat.
Right.
And it goes into chemical signatures in terms of what's the three-dimensional shape of the molecule look like.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from having hydrogens on the same side to having hydrogens on the opposite side.
Right.
Based off of where the single bond and the double bond happen to be within the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
There are naturally formed trans fats.
Okay.
And then there are man-made trans fats.
Right.
These fats are nothing new, even though, once again, for some reason, we like to think of everything that we're now facing as a brand new thing.
Phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
But we've been using partially hydrogenated fats since the 1830s, 1840s. I once again have to go back and look at my history stuff to get the specific date.
Okay.
But it's been since the mid-1800s.
All right.
Where we've been using partially hydrogenated fats, where we've been turning plant oils into solid fats.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that's been done for cooking purposes.
Yes.
Because it extends the shelf life for the products that are being made.
Right.
But the problem is that those trans fats, we don't metabolize correctly. And it becomes a reactive oxidative species in the process of being metabolized.
Oh, okay.
It becomes an ROS. It not only becomes an ROS, but it also instigates an inflammatory response to that ROS and to that trans fat. And so one of the things that has been going on within the nutrition world, mm-hmm. is this kind of debate, should I be using butter or should I be using margarine?
Yes.
And part of that goes into the previous discussion we were having about the why was the person all up in arms about the whole milk versus skim milk versus 1-2%. It goes into the fat issue and the fact that, okay, if I look at fats,
mm-hmm.
I have to look at it in terms of two things. So we'll talk about in terms of the chemistry of it, and then what's the physical property of the fat. So saturated fats are always solid and are completely combustible,
mm-hmm.
which means that when I cook it, it turns into, if I cook it to the point where it's completely heated all the way through, it turns into carbon dioxide and water. And so once again, chemical reactions.
Yeah.
A combustion reaction is a hydrocarbon plus heat plus oxygen gives me carbon dioxide and water.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like throwing this out to the students. Someone says they lose a pound of fat. Where does the fat go?
The atmosphere?
It goes into the atmosphere. It goes into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and water.
That's weird.
Nice.
That's very strange.
And it goes into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and water at about a two-thirds ratio.
That's so weird. That's
odd. So two-thirds. So for every one oxygen that we breathe in,
mm-hmm.
if we're using just the fats,
mm-hmm.
two-thirds of that is going to be exited as, in terms of the amount of oxygen that came in, is going to be exited as carbon dioxide. And that's how one of the ways that we do this, we measure what's referred to as the respiratory quotient, the RQ value.
Right.
And the RQ value tells me what fuel am I using for my metabolism. Mm-hmm. And when I'm using almost entirely fats, it's about 0.67, 0.70. And you can actually do this in terms of the mathematical stoichiometry of chemistry. So remember, in chemistry, we can't make things, we can't destroy things. All we can do is change how those things happen to be arranged.
Yeah, exactly.
Conservation of mass, conservation of atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fats I'm using for energetic purposes are those saturated fats.
Okay.
In particular, palmitic acid mm-hmm. is one of the big ones that's there. And so when I'm using those fats, that saturated fat is always solid
mm-hmm.
until it combusts and then it forms gas. The unsaturated fats,
mm-hmm.
depending upon how unsaturated it is, will go from being quasi-solid to never solid. So the polyunsaturated fats.
Yeah.
Like the olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
If you take olive oil and you put it into the fridge, it doesn't solidify. It stays liquid.
Yeah.
However, I take like canola oil
mm-hmm.
or sunflower oil
mm-hmm.
and I put it into the fridge, you'll notice that some of it will start to solidify.
Yeah.
And some of it will stay liquid. The polyunsaturated fats will always stay liquid. And so when people talk about, oh, like the bacon grease is bad for you, that's actually the good fat in the bacon.
Really?
Yeah, because that's all liquid. And so what's happened is that that's the monounsaturated fats mm-hmm. that have gone from the solid form to the liquid form.
Right.
And so when people say, oh, you don't want to have the bacon grease. Well, if we're talking about good fat versus bad fat, put quotes around good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's the better fat to have because that is the unsaturated fat.
That's weird.
My dad will love to hear that.
And so once again, so when it goes into that whole nutrition literacy, scientific literacy in terms of understanding what we're looking at. So the polyunsaturated fat is always liquid. The monounsaturated fat, when it gets cooled,
mm-hmm.
becomes solid, but when it heats up, it becomes liquid.
Huh.
And so we start looking, okay, what are these fats that we have?
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do, or what the idea around this extended use of the industrialized trans fats
mm-hmm.
is, okay, trans, if I take this unsaturated fat, which is good for me,
mm-hmm.
and I solidify it into a monounsaturated fat, which is basically what they're doing. They're taking a polyunsaturated fat and turn it into a monounsaturated fat, or taking a monounsaturated fat and turn it into a saturated fat.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing that through chemical conversions.
Right.
But the problem is that chemical conversion makes it so that we have a problem digesting that molecule down into its individual two carbon components that we need to do all the metabolism we're going to do.
Right.
Or to break it into shorter chains so I can use it to build stuff.
Right.
And so because we can't metabolize the way we're metabolizing all the other fats, it becomes a metabolic disruptor.
Yes.
And so metabolic disruptors disrupt metabolism. Hence every once in a while we actually use words that actually describe what it does.
Right. Makes sense.
And so the metabolic disruptor causes a lot of the metabolic diseases And so if you look at like all the packaging now, and there's laws out there that basically don't allow for the partially hydrogenated oils,
okay,
the trans fats in the products that we're purchasing.
Right.
And that's because high amounts of trans fats, and by high amounts, we're talking about more than about 1 gram total in a day.
Oh my God.
Of the trans fats leads to possible issues of metabolic disruption. And once again, it's possible. It's not a direct like one-to-one, this is automatically going to cause that.
Right, but it's there.
But it's there. And so when we start looking, okay, the butter versus the margarine, which is kind of where, so we don't usually hear about this in terms of the non-dairy like ice creams.
Yeah, no.
And so we don't hear about non-dairy ice creams in terms of having health issues, but we talk about in terms of margarine,
exactly.
Margarine versus butter.
Yeah.
But the non-dairy ice cream is going to have the same issue in terms of what we've done to the fats as what we see in the margarines, but we don't talk about it the same way. And that's because when we start looking at, okay, what's the problem with ice cream? Well, cream.
Yeah.
And cream has higher fat content than milk does.
Right.
And so once again, it goes into the faulty hypothesis of high fat leads to health issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good spot to stop the first part of our discussion here. Thanks for joining so far. Please make sure you check in for the second part of the episode, looking at the issues surrounding the dairy products and some of the myths and misconceptions and misnomers we have about the dairy products, milk, cream, butter, etc. Please make sure you're following on all of the various platforms that we're publishing on, here on the podcast, as well as on YouTube, as well as through the Substack, and our quick takes that we're posting onto Threads, as well as onto Instagram. Please stay tuned for the second part of the discussion, part 2 of the episode looking at milk misnomers.